Thank you, John. Good morning, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here this morning. I wasn't able to come at the beginning of the conference because of a whole lot of stuff going on, like moving my office after 22 years over the past weekend, and having a really complex thing. I try not to say a big deal because I try not to have big deals today, but having a really complex trial starting Tuesday, so I didn't get here yesterday afternoon. And the only speaker I've been able to hear was Ken last night, and Ken's just as wonderful as he's always been. And I kind of didn't have to hear Johnny and Peg and Mary Pearl to know that they were going to give you a wonderful talk. So till you got down to Sunday morning, you guys have had a wonderful conference. You really have. And I want to thank Pat and Bill and everybody that's just been so gracious and helped put on this wonderful thing. And now what we're going to do is try to get a little divine intervention, guys, because I'm going to need some this morning. And the first place we're going to need divine intervention is that something's got to get me out of the way, and it's not going to be me. I used to stand up to give an AA talk, and I'd say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this. Let me tell you something. If I could get me out of the way, I wouldn't need to be here. Getting me out of the way is absolutely too big a job for me. I can't make any headway at all on it. And by the grace of God, my sobriety date's April 9th, 1981. And I'm not a bit more capable of getting myself out of the way today than I was in April 1981. Second place we're going to need some divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions. And I really need divine intervention there. You know, when you are special like I am, I know none of you guys feel really special, but all my life, the directions have not really applied to me. Because you see, the directions are made by people who aren't nearly as smart as I am. And the people that write the directions are the biggest square johns on earth. Just button-down conservatives, and they're being advised by liability lawyers who are worse than they are. And what they're trying to do is manipulate real idiots into doing things. So they overstate everything. And a special fellow like myself has to kind of extrapolate what the directions really mean. Now, this is not, by the way, a conscious process. This happens with no conscious effort on my part. But to give you an example, if I look at something that says something like, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain will register that as really meaning something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So we're going to need the divine intervention there. And the good news is I found out when I'm willing to let God get me out of the way and try to live the steps and the principles of this program and be with you guys and listen to you guys, that the divine intervention is pretty easy to get. So I'm going to try to follow the pretty simple directions of talking a few minutes about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And there's another set of directions I just really love in the book, and I guess on Sunday mornings maybe as good a time as any to think about it. The book tells me that our personal stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our God. And I really hope that my message carries that this morning. Because when I got here, I was one of the really, really hard-headed ones. The book talks about me and we agnostic. It talks about the ones that are just absolutely offended by any mention of God. And as far as you guys using higher power, that didn't fool me a bit. I knew what you were talking about. And it insulted my intelligence maybe more than if you'd just gone ahead and said God. And what would happen is that you religious fanatics would insult my intellect and the little hairs would stand up on the back of my neck. And that would run me out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so blessed because I'm one of the ones who was allowed to live long enough for alcohol to run me back in here enough times, because I didn't have anywhere else to go, that finally I was able to take the hand that you folks had been offering me for so long and let you lead me through these 12 steps that are our only program of recovery. And those 12 steps led me to that loving God that I didn't even know was there. And that, folks, is the reason that I haven't been rotting in a pauper's grave for over 24 years. That one little miracle. So I really hope my message carries that part of it this morning. You know, my first sponsor explained to me that the first thing that's wrong with me is I've got an ego disorder. He said that's what the book means when it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. He explained that all my life I've been so obsessed with myself. I've been so obsessed with how I feel. I've been so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people. And without divine intervention all my life, up to and including this morning, without divine intervention, the bottom line will wind up being that how I feel is the most important thing in the world to me. And he explained to me that all my life I'd gotten the only result that you can get with that obsession on self. That it had so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me all my life that I'd never been able to stand the way I felt inside without either running as hard as I could and or trying to stuff something in there to make me feel good enough that I could stand it. on account of that ego disorder, I was never able to give any consideration to the possibility of a personal God. I was usually all right with some sort of intellectual theory about a creative force, but when it got down to the possibility that there was something more important in the actual conducting and unfolding of my life a minute at a time than my brain, my ego vetoed that and said, no way, we can't give it any consideration whatsoever. And I think on account of that I didn't have any teachability or humility at all until I got sober. And I was 37 when I got sober in 1981. And the reason I don't believe I'd had any teachability or humility at all is I've never been able to remember a single time in that first 37 years of my life that I voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it and I agreed with it, and I thought it would work. And what's scary is that sounds pretty good to me this morning. I mean, after all, why should I do something voluntarily about my life if I don't understand it, or I don't agree with it, or I don't think it'll work? When I get honest, it's real simple. I've got a talking illness. My alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life, and I've always had an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head, and I want to tell you, for me, recovery has not been that those things have gone away. Those things are alive and well. I'll be standing and talking to the bank teller that I've been doing business with for 15 years, talking to her about the pictures of her children that I've watched grow up, you know, and I'll tell you in a minute about a car wreck I had when I was drinking. I'm pretty well crippled up. I couldn't run if my life depended on it. But I'll be standing there chatting with Terry, and I'll look over and see a stack of $100 bills, and it'll go through my mind to grab them and run. And that doesn't even bother me. I'm not going to do that. But it's alive and well. And you know, if I had to pick one single thing that's the scariest thing about my alcoholism, it might be this. In all that talking that my alcoholism has done to me, I don't believe it has ever tried to kill me. Now, I've nearly died of alcoholism dozens of times. But here's why I don't think it's ever tried to kill me. I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether I live or die. And I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether you live or die. I believe my alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. I believe it's only got one reason for existing, and that's to try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to try to get it. It'll tell me something that might kill you or me or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another. It doesn't ever, without dropping a stitch, it doesn't care. Slings it all up against the wall and just hopes some of it will stick. Well, what my recovery has been is that most of the time, I can realize that what my alcoholism is telling me is not reality, and I don't have to obey it. But if I could do that 100% of the time, I probably wouldn't need to go to a whole lot of meetings. Probably wouldn't need to do a whole lot. But my alcoholism is absolutely throughout my whole being. I really believe, and I'm not saying this just to appear to be bad or something. I truly believe that there is no story of Don Major other than the story of alcoholism and the recovery from it. I believe that with all my heart. And one big part of my alcoholism is that if it's anything at all, it is a disorder of my perception, which of course means quite literally that I don't always see things right. I don't always hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line is real simple. When I put that final say-so in the universe in my little old brain, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it, I agree with it, and I think it'll work, with what I've got wrong with me, I have just put myself under death sentence. And I believe that with all my heart. My body grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, and my childhood, the first 12 or 13 years of my life, weren't a thing like I thought they were. Just not a thing. Up until I got sober, I would tell you the saga. It wasn't just a story, it was a saga. About my early struggles from the depths of poverty and to the heights of power that I had, those staggering heights of power that I'd reached. And, of course, it was all about using my iron will and my sterling intellect to pull myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights. And I believed that crap so sincerely I'd get you and me both crying before I was halfway done. And I wasn't sober a week when I realized that was all a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't close to poor. We were middle-class farming people who had everything we needed and a lot of the things that we wanted. And you can bet that those staggering heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. When I look back on those early years now, what was going on was that selfishness and self-centeredness. Since there wasn't any divine intervention, how I felt was the most important thing in the universe. And I was getting that only result that I can get from self-obsession. And by the way, I don't give up on self-obsession very easily. Since I've been sober in the last 24 years, I have figured that if a fellow dressed self-obsession up in spiritual clothing, you ought to be able to get away with it. From time to time, I've thought if a fellow dressed self-obsession up in psychological clothing, you ought to be able to get away with it. There just ought to be some way to effectively treat an illness that is selfishness and self-centeredness by obsession on self. But it just doesn't work that way. It's like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. My problem is my self-centeredness. Now, sure, folks say AA is a selfish program, and I have no quarrel with that because I know what they're trying to get across. And it's an extremely valid point. That is, that if I don't stay sober, I wind up not being any good to myself or anybody else. But as far as it's a self-caring program. But folks, selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of my troubles. And the only relief I'm ever going to get from it is laying aside whether I'm loved, comforted, and understood, and trying to love, comfort, and understand you. I will never get any relief from that pain until I do that. I believe it's a spiritual law that as long as I'm trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me, I cannot be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. It's only when I'm praying to lay that aside and trying to love, comfort, and understand you that I can be full, that I can be fulfilled and loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. But at any rate, I got drunk the first time when I was either 12 or 13 years old. And that first night I got in a lot of trouble. I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover. Swore all those Baptists around there were right and that I would never do it again. And I was sincere. And it actually worked pretty well. It was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And most of you have got a similar experience to share. It's that the first time I got enough of that stuff in me, it did something about that pain and that emptiness inside me that obsession with myself had created all my life. For the first time in my life, it made me feel good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt without running. And since the way I feel is the most important thing in the universe to me without divine intervention, for the next 25 years, it was pretty simple. When I wanted to change the way I felt, the real bottom line was it didn't matter what it cost. And it didn't matter who it cost. And I'm not going to spend any time on the drunk log much this morning. I want to talk about recovery and living sober if I can. So I'm going to try to get through it pretty quick, but I do want to tell you enough about it to let you know that I didn't come here because the stuff gave me the hiccups. From that first drunk until I got sober 25 years later, alcohol dominated everything in my life. Not just alcoholism. I'm talking about alcohol dominated. I never apologized for my drinking, not one time, nowhere, to no one. I don't believe that I ever started out telling myself or anybody else that I was just going to have a drink or two. I never wanted a drink or two. A drink or two never did anything for me except make my mouth taste like cotton, make my head hurt, and make me need to get something to drink real, real bad. By the time I was in my mid-teens, I had figured out that if anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, they would wind up blowing the whistle on my drinking. You know, it would go something like this. You know, wait a minute, Don. You're a nice guy in a lot of ways, and being around you gets exciting from time to time. But there's something wrong. There's something wrong with the way you drink, something wrong with the way you live. And when you blew that whistle, if I couldn't change your mind, and I got pretty good at changing your mind, but if I couldn't change your mind, I had to get you out of my life. It didn't matter how much another part of me cared for you and how much another part of me wanted you in my life. The bottom line was quite simple. Without divine intervention, the way I felt was the most important thing in the universe. And if you were going to interfere with the only thing that did the trick for me, I couldn't afford to have you in my life. And sometimes the way I put that is that I believe for the last 20 years I drank, I didn't even have people in my life. I believe I had positions. And whatever your position was in my life, I probably had a replacement interviewed at any given time. And I'm really not proud of that at all. I've had to do an awful lot of amends work on account of that. And I think it's a pretty darn good partial description of a sociopath. But it's simply the way that I lived, with positions in my life rather than people. School was really easy for me, and by the time I was 16, my egomania with an inferiority complex, which has driven me all my life and continues to today. And let me tell you what I mean by my egomania with an inferiority complex. Without divine intervention, I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody and not nearly good enough for that same thing or that same person at the same time. You know, just at the same instant, it seems like I can harbor those totally opposed feelings. It seems like the thing that I cannot feel without divine intervention is okay for anything or anybody on the face of this earth. And by the time I was 16, on one hand, I'd gotten in enough trouble with my drinking and was embarrassed enough about my drinking situation. And on the other hand, it was so clear that that farming community couldn't hold one of my magnificence that the combination of that ran me away from there. And when I was, of course, I had not finished high school, and I took a Greyhound bus 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville there in Kentucky. And I kicked around for 3 or 4 days and wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. School had always been easy for me. And they gave me a bunch of tests and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And the first semester I laid so drunk that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to and passing out and coming to. And, of course, blew my scholarship. So I went to work full-time, and over the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, went to school full-time, and drank full-time, and somehow finished undergraduate and law school. And I have no idea how that happened. It's just a gray, whirling, alcoholic blur of insanity. I've got very few memories of that whole 7.5 years. Spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter Dana, who was my only child for over 20 years, was born. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for about 10 years with really good, pretty good little bit of material success. Not nearly as much as I used to think I'd had. And now, I'm not talking about just when I was drinking. I'm talking about the first few years I was sober and giving AA talks. You could have put me on the lie detector box and the needle would never have wavered when I explained to you that if it hadn't been for a little problem with booze and dope and just a tad of procrastination, that I'd probably been greater than Clarence Darrow. The fact is, I realize now that if I'm blessed to live and stay sober 30 or 35 years, I may find out I was a total failure. I don't know, but best I can do today is I was reasonably materially successful. I always had a knack for getting a lot of publicity. I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I had a lot of things, and that's what I would stick in your nose when you would suggest that something was wrong with somebody who lived the way that I did, and it was total insanity. During that 10 years, and by the way, something I usually say just to give you an idea of how pervasive alcohol itself was in my life, that first 25 years, the whole 25 years I drank, I'm confident that I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights. In fact, since they've lowered that legally drunk to .08, I may have woke up legally drunk over half the mornings. And that's not a joke. I mean, that's true. I mean, alcohol was everywhere. You either accepted that alcohol was the center of my life or you got out of my life. And that was just simply the way it was. That 10 years after I started practicing law, the first 10 years that I practiced was nuts. I started using a lot of things other than the alcohol. And during that 10 years, they were, for me, exactly like they were with Bill and Bob. And if Bill and Bob can't tell their story in the big book without mentioning drugs, I don't see how I can. And the fact is that during those 10 years, the booze was the big tent. The booze was the main attraction. The other things were things to change the effect of the booze, to increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the big tent. February 10th of 1978, I'd been practicing law almost 10 years. I was still holding on to my material world by my fingernails, but I still had it. I still had the fancy cars and the law firm and all the things that go with that. And on that day, I got full of scotch, cocaine, Quaaludes, speed, and vodka. And I drove a new Corvette off the road at over 130 miles an hour. Now, since the roads were icy, it was probably poor judgment to be driving 130 miles an hour. And for years, I blamed that fiberglass Corvette for that wreck and those injuries. And to give you an idea, and again, you know, an alcoholic can brag about how bad they are as easily as they can brag about how good they are. Sometimes a little easier, I think, but to give you an idea of where I was with my substance abuse, I was so full of all those things that I just listed. My blood alcohol, when they got me to a major medical center, was over .40 with all those other things in my body, and I wasn't even a blackout. And the only measure I ever had for drunk, you know, I talked about going to bed legally drunk. I certainly didn't know I was drunk that often, because the only standard for drunk I ever had in my life was whether I blacked out or not. If I remembered everything, case closed, end of discussion, I was not drunk. I had a young lady with me that was not my daughter's mother at that time, and at that time I was remarried to my daughter's mother. Now, I'm going to make what I hope is my sole sociological observation this morning. Please feel free to ignore it. It is not in the big book. But as far as I'm concerned, the fact that I was remarried to my daughter's mother establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. Now, that is not because there is anything wrong with my daughter's mother. It's because in the last 24 and a half years, I've just kind of observed, and I don't believe in the history of the world anybody ever did that but us. I believe that if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum getting in to try to protect themselves. And we do it just routinely, drunk and sober. Old Joe and Sue are divorced, but they're dating. They'll probably get back together. And the weird thing is, it works for us sometimes. I'm not even saying it's bad. It's just different. Normies don't do that crap. But at any rate, I was remarried to her, and it was not she that I had with me when I had the wreck. Wreck did a lot of bad things to my body. Broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg. They had to do a bypass, take out a vein from the upper leg, graft it in to replace the artery, and separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a suprapubic catheter, they call it, with a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And I had a half dozen major surgeries that first year and was in the hospital more than 6 months of that first year. Early on, the doctors told me that I would never walk again without braces on both legs and one or two canes, and that they doubted seriously that we would be able to find a surgeon anywhere that would even attempt to put the ends of my plumbing back together so that I would ever have a urinary function. Now, just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, I've been sober a little over 24 and a half years, and I haven't owned a brace or a cane for probably close to 26 years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. And while I was laying in that hospital bed, after I got out of intensive care, I had them move me back to Louisville where they knew who I was and would treat me with the proper deference. And you know, looking back on it, I guess they might have known who I was, because I laid in those hospitals for months in Louisville, and every single day my friends brought me in booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me, and nobody ever said a single word about it. And I would lay there in that bed with that prognosis, and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough, but it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And then I'd explain to him that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he wasn't prepared to do the time. And just because we'd hit a little bump in the road, they weren't going to hear me whining. So give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that's real insanity. And that's real powerlessness. I didn't go broke right away after that wreck, because a little law firm of 7 or 8 lawyers had built up around this other guy and myself. My daughter's mother, of course, was not pleased with the circumstances of the wreck and divorced me again right after it. And I wound up married to the young lady who was with me when I had the wreck, who was hurt but not nearly as badly as I. And about a year after that wreck, I still had my tube in my belly. I still had my catheter bag and the braces on my legs and my crutches. And I made my first trip to the asylum sometime around the first of the year of 1979. And I don't use the word asylum to be cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in the Big Book, and my mama used that word. When I was a kid in the country, I don't remember talk about folks having breakdowns and going to hospitals. I remember talk about people going crazy and being put in asylums. And that is far more descriptive of what kept happening to me, let me assure you. And by the time I got in that first one, the phenomenon of craving that the Big Book talks about had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking alcohol, once it got any in my body, and that's all the phenomenon of craving is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And once I got any in my body by that time, I just physically lost the ability to stop. I've never felt a physical thing as strong as the last couple of hundred times I checked on my phenomenon of craving. Nothing to do with the drugs, nothing to do with the surgeries, nothing. Most horrible physical thing I've ever gone through in my life. And by that time, something had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And when it did, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be able to do something like sit up in a chair. I usually say that if you were progressed that far with your craving the last time you checked on it, you don't need a description of those 3 or 4 days. But if you were not progressed that far the last time you checked on it, I would be wasting my time. Because I don't think anybody can convey in words what that craving grows into in us and what happens to us. But at any rate, they got me in that first asylum. They got me through the 3 or 4 days. They set me up in a chair and for some reason thought an AA meeting might be appropriate in my case. And so they had an AA meeting there in the asylum. And somebody got up and read the steps. They got step three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to God as we understood Him. And, of course, it insulted my intellect, so I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on over the telephone to call somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Now, that was sometime around the first of the year 1979. I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81, and I really don't remember much of that. But some things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie. And I'm real grateful for that, because that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded. And I proved I wasn't going to get straight as long as I had a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to do it with a law firm. And let me say something about bottom, about hitting bottom. You know, the first few years I was sober, bottom was the most mysterious and, frankly, unfair thing I could imagine. It seemed like we alcoholics were like little dry leaves out here on the wind. And if we got blessed and or lucky and got blown to bottom, man, it was wonderful. We got to get in AA and do the steps and get spiritual and have friends and make money and have sex and everything. It was just absolutely wonderful. But if you happened to catch a bad downdraft or updraft and couldn't get blown to bottom, well, you just had to die a mad dog death. And it seemed like a peculiar way for a loving God to set up a universe. And I know now that it's not that way at all. You see, my bottoms are not me being a dry leaf and getting blown. My bottoms are a decision. And words are really important to me in sobriety. And the reason they are is that I've learned that what I call something is probably what it's going to be and how I define it. For instance, as long as I thought an attitude was a state of mind and a state of emotion, which is what I was convinced of until early in sobriety, my sponsor sent me to a dictionary, I was panicked because people were telling me to change my attitude and I couldn't change a thing. I was looking for all those switches inside to flip, to change my mindset and my emotional being towards something, and I couldn't change a thing. But my sponsor sent me to a dictionary. And in that dictionary, a definition of attitude was angle of approach. And it was like flipping a light. You see, my angle of approach to you or anything on this earth has nothing to do with what I think about you or it. Has nothing to do with how I feel about you or it. It has everything to do with how I act toward you. That is my attitude. Another example of why words are so important. All my life, I would tell you that I know something, or I would tell you that I realize something, and those were interchangeable, like they meant the same thing. It never occurred to me that the word realize is a form of the word real. And when I have realized something, that literally means that it has become real inside me. And that's so different from knowing it. The things I've known for 30 years that I haven't realized, that aren't real inside me. And the next thing, which takes me back to where I was on that bottom deal, is decision. All my life, if I formed an intention to do something, I would tell you I've made a decision to do that. Now, my intentions don't become decisions until I'm acting on them. And I try to be very careful not to tell you I've made a decision to do something if all I've done is formed an intention to do it. And all my bottoms, and by the way, booze and dope were just my first bottom. I think I've hit bottom on something about every 8 days for over 24 years. And all my bottoms are the same thing. They are a decision over which I have so much control. They are a decision that I'll do anything to keep from living the way I've been living and feeling the way I've been feeling. And when I've made that decision, by definition, I'm acting on it, I've hit bottom. Until I've done that, doesn't make any difference how many bodily functions I lose, doesn't make any difference how many times I go to jail, doesn't make any difference how many people around me die. Until I make that decision, and I'm acting on it by definition, that I'll do anything to keep from feeling the way I've been feeling and living the way I've been living, I haven't hit bottom. But at any rate, back in those days, I wasn't going to hit bottom as long as I had anything. Right after the boys kicked me out of the law firm, the state of Kentucky jerked my law license. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity, and she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident during that period. I last laid eyes on my only child in January of 1980, and I didn't see her again until February of 1983, the same month I met Ken down here. Over 3 years, I didn't see her talk to me to what was my only child then. After all the money the mortgage companies took, the houses the ex-wives were in, my law partners and I had built an office building in downtown Louisville, and the Internal Revenue took my part of that and some things like that. And after it was all gone, my dad was in his late 80s on the farm. Didn't have anything in the world but his Social Security, and I stole that to keep on drinking on. And got a much older sister who I buried almost a year and a half ago, Sarah. And Sarah was crippled from polio that she had as a childhood, in her childhood. Wonderful, beautiful, spiritual human being. And I used Sarah and abused her and endangered her very life to keep on drinking and drugging. I burned every bridge. And for almost a year and a half, up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address. I lived on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And the way that happened... The way that happened it is easy. Looking back on it, you see, a good half of those places I'm calling asylums had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go between trips to the asylum, if I was able, sometimes I would go to an awful lot of meetings. So I had a head full of information about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it's one of my frequent and sincere prayers that I never know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that with all my heart. That's not a joke line. And what would happen during that year and a half is one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain, my alcoholism, and they are one and the same thing, don't kid yourself, would go, I know it works for you guys, but you don't know how magnificently different I am. You don't understand this ocean of creativity and compassion inside me, and you don't know that I see things more clearly than ordinary people, and my God, I feel them so much more acutely that I'm just wounded by my own understanding. And you, of course I knew I was an alcoholic, and for that matter, a dope fiend too. But my God, those were just little symptoms or results of what was really wrong. This terrible, magnificently complex thing, and I'd get teary-eyed, so grateful that you simple-minded folks could babble about your myth of a higher power and dress these little symptoms of alcoholism and drug addiction and somehow expect the bigger picture to go away. But alas, it couldn't work for me in my magnificence. Now, here's the nightmare. The very next heartbeat, one of you would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain would go, yeah, I know, but you don't know how bad I am. You don't know about the parts of me that are missing and always have been. You don't know that I've never been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself, not really. You don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my life. And you don't know that anything in my life that even looks like it was okay, much less good, is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. I've destroyed absolutely everything. If I were to manage to stay straight for a couple of months, it would just be to be blown into by a sawed-off shotgun or go to the penitentiary for the rest of my life. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Very mixed heartbeat. It'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I'm so wonderful. And I was believing it both times, just rolling right on. Fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of asylum number 17 in Nashville, Tennessee. They let me in. They told me later to keep me from dying on the street. They didn't think I would live a week. And I stayed there about a month, and it was time I had to get out, and I had no place to go. And I had a roommate there who was a young fella. And his family lived in Nashville and felt sorry for me. And they said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days? Let's try to figure out what to do with you. So I went and lived with them a year on charity. And the first 6 months I lived with him, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe I really needed to get better before I could become constitutionally capable. And I believe that what what the book's talking about when it talks about the constitutionally incapable are those who just don't have the physical, mental capacity to grasp what's going on. And I believe my brain and my ability to comprehend was to the point where I had to get better before I could become constitutionally capable. And during that 6 months, I went to an awful lot of meetings, most of them at a clubhouse there in Nashville called the 202 Club. I got to where I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped, and that was a world record for me. I'd never been 30 days without getting ripped in my life since I got drunk the first time. That was in or out of an asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. How I really know I got better is they only put me back in one rubber room in that whole 6 month period. And at the rate I'd been going, I would have thought twice a year in the asylum was the picture of mental health. I would have settled for it in a heartbeat. Late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And I've drunk a barrel of both of them and actually have better memories of the Listerine. I can stand to smell Listerine today, but I can't stand to smell that old pop-off. But you couldn't smell, you know, couldn't smell vodka when we were drinking. That's odd how that changes. But during this most recent drunk, I was drinking everything I could find, taking everything I could find. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, the most recent day I drank, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, and 11 God gave me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks I was sober, I had no idea that there was love in God or that anything had given me any gifts, because coming off that most recent drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. I wasn't aware of my mind being changed about anything. Guys, I haven't seen a burning bush yet. If I had waited to see a burning bush, if I had waited to start believing that Alcoholics Anonymous would work in my special case, if I had waited until it felt like it was working to start blindly doing what you guys in this big book told me to do, I would have been rotting in that pauper's grave somewhere around Nashville for over 24 years. The biggest gift my loving God had given me, and I had no idea I had it, was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to follow some directions that I didn't understand, that I didn't agree with, and I didn't think would work, and I certainly didn't want to do. And I had no idea that I had that gift. And 3 or 4 days after the most recent drink, I stumbled back to the door of that clubhouse in Nashville. Didn't think they would let me in. They really should not have let me in. I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They'd caught me shooting dope in their men's room. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, a big old tall boy by the name of Joe Wall. Joe died a couple of years ago, bless his heart. Walked up and looked. Joe was big, about 6'6". He walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. I really did. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God these people have finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But Joe went on and he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, because we've never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that was like an icy hand grabbing something inside me. And it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door. And they did let me in. I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, "Come on in. You're keeping us sober." And I said, "Will y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I won't live?" And they said, "Sure. Don't drink. Don't take. Don't go to meetings." By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I clearly remember that during those 60 days, it was obvious to me that that was way more of those stupid meetings than I needed to be going to. It was obvious to me that you guys were religious fanatics and that I was getting very little out of it. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, good-looking woman, big car, be somebody, for heaven's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had, of being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, partner, I know, but you and I have nearly killed one another, and we don't have anything left to do except go to these dumb old meetings." And the miracle, the sunshine is that those meetings worked just as well as if I had thought, felt, and believed they were exactly what I needed. I had it all backwards. I thought in order for AA to work, I had to believe it would work. I thought it had to feel like it was working. The truth is, I thought I ought to be able to see the causal relationship of A causing B. Had nothing on earth to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there, kicking and screaming behind the raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, I've read the big book several times. And they said, we know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying, dummy. They said, you've got it in your head that this book is some sort of philosophy book. And there's something in there you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. They said, partner, it ain't going to happen. So there's nothing in there you can learn that will keep you sober for a heartbeat. In fact, they said, Don, you've bought a bill of goods that Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery is somehow a learning process. They said, don't you believe that crap. They said, you've got to learn just a tiny little bit before you get started. But they said, let me tell you, though, Don, you have had enough information about Alcoholics Anonymous for over 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without one single new piece of information about Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, this deal isn't about what you know and don't know. What's killing you is what you're doing and not doing. They said, recovery is not really a learning process. Recovery is a doing process. And this book is not a philosophy book. It's a simple instruction manual for your actions. In fact, they said, Don, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the solution to your alcoholism. And I said, time out. You've been telling me for 2.5 years that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the solution to my alcoholism. And they said, no, we haven't. We have been telling you that the action described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the solution to your alcoholism. And they said, if you want to live, you better understand that those 12 steps are the only program of recovery. In fact, they're the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you can be a member of this fellowship on any day you've got a desire to stop drinking. And the fellowship is absolutely essential. But as far as the program of recovery, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless you are somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9 the way this book says do them, or having done that, you're living every day of your life in order to do the action that is the maintenance of your spiritual condition. And you know, that was one of the most wonderful revelations of my sobriety. I'm going to take a quick side trip. For the first few years that I was sober, I thought my sobriety was contingent on my spiritual condition. Again, I could have quoted exactly what the book says on it, but I thought what it really meant was that my sobriety was contingent on my spiritual condition. And I'd get scared to death, man, because I don't know about some of you. Some of you may have got so exalted that you all always wake up feeling like you're just one with the universe, you know, and ready to just go tripping out in the ether and merge with the Tao. But I still wake up sometimes scared with my brain spinning, you know, and I wake up sometimes when I try to read my meditation books, it seems like I can't remember the last word I just tried to read. When I try to pray, sometimes it seems like the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling. So it seems like to me, my spiritual condition is el crapo. And as long as I thought my daily reprieve was contingent on how I am, it was kind of scary. I was back to being that dry leaf on the wind. I might get struck drunk. But that's not what the book says. It says my daily reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I drove a car up here sitting out there. That car has some condition. You know, that's the way that car is today. And there's not a thing on earth I can do to wave a wand to immediately change the condition of that car. On the other hand, there is a process of maintaining that automobile, which is all action over which I have 100% control. So you see, I know now I don't get my daily reprieve based on how I am in the big picture. I get my daily reprieve based on what I do within that 24 hours. And if I take the actions I know to take, I believe this book guarantees me that for that 24 hours, I'm not going to take a drink of alcohol. But at any rate, what they explained to me was that if I wanted to live, I needed to come to this book like a little child and act like I'd never seen it before, and start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part and not interpreting one single thing and not looking for anything to learn or argue with or distinguish, looking for only what it said do. And they explained to me that if I would do that, that I'd be all right a day at a time. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night and ask a power greater than myself to get through the day and thank that power at night, and the tears came to my eyes. And I explained to them, which was true, that ever since I had first been exposed to AA 2.5 years before then, it had been clear to me that if I was going to live, I was going to have to somehow start thinking, feeling, and believing more like it looked like to me you guys thought, felt, and believed. And I had tried. I had tried to adjust all my internal knobs and switches to change what I thought, felt, and believed. And I couldn't change any of them. So I'm sitting there with tears coming down my cheeks saying, God, that's what's killing me. I can't do it. The second step's killing me. And they said, Don, you've got that backwards too. They said, we have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And I'm sure my mouth fell open because at the absolute core of this disordered ego of mine is this insane conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. My Lord, we can't have Donnie doing something he doesn't feel like doing. You know, if I don't feel like doing the right thing, every fiber of my being here over 24 years sober wants to address the problem of making me feel like doing right so I can do right. And if you're one of my AA friends, I'm after aggravate you to death, calling you up, Ken, I don't feel like doing this. What can we do to make me feel like doing it? Well, I've got some terrible news this morning. In the time I've been in AA, I have prayed until I was blue in the face, trying to get God to make me feel like doing right so I can do right. I have worried sponsors to distractions. I have done enough inventories that if they stacked up, it'd be somewhere between my knee and hip, I'm sure. And I spent a pretty good little piece of change on outside counseling, trying to get me to feel like doing right so I can do right. And here's the horrible news. Not one single time has anything ever made me feel like doing right except going on doing right when I don't feel like it. I just hate that. It's more maturity than I can nearly stand. But at any rate, these guys told me in Nashville 1981, they said, no. I said, Don, we'd never suggest you think, feel, or believe anything. They said, in the first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. They said, in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die will be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have a thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees, you start saying those words, and don't worry about what's going through your head because it won't count. So sometime in April of 81, I started getting on my knees morning and night and totally acting as if, 100%, not believing for an instant that it would work. And somewhere along the line, the miracle of the second step began to happen. And they led me through the, and by the way, to my knowledge, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 81. And I sponsor different from other people. I don't tell anybody that they have to do something for me to be their sponsor. I have hard enough time knowing what I need to do. But I do tell folks some things like this. I tell them, you know, getting on your knees morning and night is ultimately up to you. But please don't ask me for any helpful hints on how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night, because I don't have one day's experience in it. I am absolutely unable to do it. So if you're going to do that, you're going to have to get on your own, because I do not know how to stay sober without getting on my knees every morning and every night. Now, I'm not telling you that to tell you how good I am. Truth is, in all those thousands of mornings and nights between April of 81 and now, probably around 50% of them, I really haven't wanted to get down there. A pretty good percentage of the time, I have not felt like getting down there, and a good part of that time, I could have gotten a medical statement that I didn't feel like it. I've had several major surgeries sober, you know, and climbed down there and gotten on those knees. There were many a time I could have gotten affidavits from judges and lawyers that I didn't have time to do it, and there have been a whole bunch of mornings where the brain was spinning and where it was clear to me that the praying wasn't doing a bit of good. The words were bouncing off the walls and ceiling. Couldn't possibly have been doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning and every night, and something's worked every single day. And by God's grace, I didn't not do it this morning, and I hope that I'm able to do it tonight and again tomorrow. It's the second most important thing in my sobriety. The most important thing in my sobriety is simple. Because, you see, I would have died if somebody hadn't finally got the point across to me that powerless over alcohol did not mean powerless over my elbow. I thought if AA didn't immediately make me not want to drink real bad, it wasn't working. They finally got it through my head that I was probably going to have to do the first mature things I'd ever done in my life. That neither you guys nor the higher power you were babbling about were ever going to knock a drink out of my hand. That I was going to have to do some things I really didn't want to do and not do some things I really wanted to do. Now, before any of you new folks panic, when I was about 2 or 3 months sober, I added to my prayer, please get me through the day without wanting to drink a drug, and it's worked every single day. I haven't wanted to drink a drug in probably about 24 and a half years, one day at a time, but I would never have lived to get there. If I hadn't have committed that, and that it was my responsibility for bending my elbow, pouring that crap in my mouth, and swallowing it. I can't abdicate that responsibility to you guys. God will not let me abdicate that responsibility to God. That is my responsibility. But at any rate, then they told me, they led me through the steps. Got me through the third step. Got it through my head that it was just a decision, that it didn't turn anything over to God, that it wasn't nearly the great big magnificent thing, and it wasn't a process that happened to me. They explained to me, you've either gone in a room with an understanding person and done that prayer on page 63 and intended for it to be the watershed moment when you started trying to do it God's way instead of yours, or you hadn't done the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, if you hear somebody in a discussion meeting wondering if they've done the third step, don't worry about it, they haven't, because third step's an action step. But that was too simple for me. It was kind of intellectually insulting that third step was that simple, really. So I knew where the complexity was. I said, okay, so I'm making a decision, but how do I implement that decision? They said, that's just as easy. All you're deciding to do is the rest of the steps and try to do the next right thing instead of what you want to do. And they said, if you'll do that, God will make your life and will what it should be. I went through steps 4 and 5, formed a picture of what a spiritual dawn ought to look like, blew past 6 and 7, thought that was where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I decided a spiritual dawn ought to look like. I lived in Nashville sober for 21 months and was never able to get a job. When I celebrated a year sober, I was in an attic with no phone, no car, teeth rotting out of my head, happier than I'd ever been in my life. At about a year and a half sober, as a pure byproduct of steps 7 and 8 or 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order. And in January of 1983, scared to death, I went back up I-65 to start back practicing law. I didn't think Louisville AA would work for me, and I really didn't think it would. But I didn't have any choice, so I threw myself in those old dumb Louisville AA meetings. And it wasn't 30 days before I decided they were even better than the Nashville ones. And that second month back, when I met Ken, by God incidents, I wound up talking in front of 2,000 people at the Kentucky State Convention because a speaker got snowed in. And that same month, I saw my daughter for the first time in over 3 years. And she's been in Al-Anon over 20 years. And she and I are dear friends. She spent a week with us over Christmas with her year-and-a-half-old baby and going to have another one in May. Wonderful things started happening. I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week, and I've always tried to do what I'm asking Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first 8 or 9 years of my sobriety were great. But the first 8 or 9 years I was sober, relationships with opposite sex and financial chaos liked to kill me. They liked to have beat me to death. And Lord, I worked on it so hard. Whatever character defect was making me uncomfortable and was inconsistent with this little picture of a spiritual dawn I'd formed when I did my 4th and 5th step, I'd grab that sucker by the collar, and here are the tools I'd use on it. I'd use prayer, rigorous honesty, meetings, steps, sponsors, outside counseling. I'd slam it up against the wall and say, come here, God, give me a little help. Let's get rid of this sucker. And God never came, and I didn't know what was wrong. And then something happened in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober. And I'm not going to go into it because I'm going to sit down in a minute. But something happened to cause me to look again at 6 and 7. And you see, I knew what the seventh step prayer said. I could have quoted it to you backwards. If you'd sat down at a table with me, I could have started at the last word and worked back to the first word. But I didn't realize that that prayer really means what it says. It doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It certainly does not ask God to remove the ones that are making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. In fact, I've come to realize that as long as I'm praying for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone, because it's making me uncomfortable, I might as well be praying for a bright red Ferrari because I'm praying for my own selfish ends. And the book tells us that doesn't work. What the prayer asks is that God remove every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And I don't have a clue which ones they are. Not a clue. It turned out I had to go back to step three. I had to come back to my God as a little child and say, Mom, Dad, I don't know where we are or how we got here, but I'm going to quit trying to figure out the pattern. And I'm going to listen to that little spark of you that's inside every human being to tell me where to take the stitch. And even when my brain tells me that if I keep to take the stitch in that direction, I'm not going to like the pattern, I'm going to try my best to just let you tell me where to stitch and leave that pattern up to you. You see, without divine intervention, what I want to do is figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. That's caused a lot of problems because I'm 62 years old and I've never figured out a single pattern correctly. Not one. And yet I waste all this time doing it, my job stitching. I'll close by telling you a little bit about what's happened in the last 15 years since May of 1990. It's almost 16 now, isn't it? If I had made a list of the things that I wanted in every area of my life and given it to God in May of 1990, I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to stumble, and I do it so imperfectly. You know, I thought all that stumbling and getting up and starting over that sometimes I do 50 times a day or 100 times a day. I thought every one was an interruption to my spiritual growth. I know now that's the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. And my God seems to be just tickled to death with that. He or she doesn't seem to require perfection or even consistency with me. My God seems to be just real happy with persistence. Getting knocked over by self-will, getting up, dusting myself off, saying, oops, Mom, Dad, excuse me, taking another couple of stitches, getting knocked over again. But if I'd made that list and I'd given it to God and God had said, I'm sick of your whining, I'm giving you everything you want on that list, I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. Every single area. My finances have been so blessed and straightened out. About 10 days ago, I celebrated 15 years married to my wife, Sharon. Some of you folks know Sharon, and we don't have a perfectly peaceful deal, but it's so much better than anything I ever imagined that there's no comparison, just no comparison. The Bar Association that kicked me out so loudly and so publicly because I did not have what we call a quiet withdrawal from the Bar Association. There wasn't a lawyer in Kentucky that would have peed on me if I was on fire. And that's the way it should have been. They have given me so many honors that it truly is embarrassing. And I've told you guys what I did with my life. I'm going to tell you real briefly what God's done with that part of my life. Years ago, they called me and put me on a committee of that we have there that interviews people who want to be judges to pass on whether they are qualified. They made me chairman of that committee. They made me a master at the end of court where I sat there with people that had won a little bitty step from the United States Supreme Court, the very few at the very top of the legal profession in the state of Kentucky, and one little drunk criminal lawyer. And I've got a line of young lawyers that would like to practice a case with me that would stretch back to that wall. Not to make any money. They just want to practice a case with me. And it's not because I'm brilliant. In fact, I haven't raised my voice in a courtroom for over 20 years. It's because on good days, I can go in there and not try to win cases. I can go in there and not try to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver. I can go in there to try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. And it's just like Chuck C. says in New Pair of Glasses. You can look them straight in the eye and tell them exactly what you're doing, and they'll think, that can't possibly be it. Don's still not giving me his secret. But when I do that, things work so well. And I guess the most ironic and funny thing happened about a year ago. I was sitting in a barber chair, and my flip cell phone rang. And it was the president of the Kentucky State Bar Association. And he said, Don, we have got a vacancy on the ethics committee. Now, the first 10 years I practiced law, the only people on earth I was more afraid of than the State Bar Ethics Committee were the IRS and the FBI. And for the last little more than a year, God has put me on that and allowed me to function that. And thank you all so much. And you new folks, keep coming back. If you're an alcoholic like me, you haven't got any place else to go. And also, you're not going to find any boredom here. You know, I was so scared of boredom when I was drinking that I'd get ripped on Tuesday, afraid I'd get bored on Thursday. And it looked so boring living without booze and dope that many times I actively choose to pick it up and die instead of living that boringly. And here's the bottom line. I haven't been bored 1 second since April 9th of 1981. Most beautiful, wonderful, joyful way of life in the world. I love all of you and thank you for a wonderful conference.